meant. Felicia, however, was fully conscious of the facts. She knew just what had happened and why. She was talking over her future plans with her cousin Rachel a few days after the funerals. Mrs. Winslow and Rachel had left Raymond and come to Chicago at once, as soon as the terrible news had reached them, and with other friends of the family were planning for the future of Rose and Felicia. Felicia, you and Rose must come to Raymond with us. That is settled. Mother will not hear to any other plan at present, Rachel had said, while her beautiful face glowed with love for her cousin, a love that had deepened day by day and was intensified by the knowledge that they both belonged to the new discipleship. Unless I can find something to do here, answered Felicia. She looked wistfully at Rachel, and Rachel said gently, What could you do, dear? Nothing. I was never taught to do anything except a little music, and I do not know enough about it to teach it or earn my living at it. I have learned to cook a little, Felicia added with a slight smile. Then you can cook for us. Mother is always having trouble with her kitchen, said Rachel, understanding well enough she was now dependent for her very food and shelter upon the kindness of family friends. It is true the girls received a little something out of the wreck of their father's fortune, but with the speculator's mad folly he had managed to involve both his wife's and his children's portion in the common ruin. Can I? Can I? Felicia responded to Rachel's proposition, as if it were to be considered seriously. I am ready to do anything honorable to make my living in that of Rose. Poor Rose. She'll never be able to get over the shock of all our trouble. We will arrange the details when we get to Raymond, Rachel said, smiling through her tears at Felicia's eager willingness to care for herself. So in a few weeks, Rose and Felicia found themselves a part of the Winslow family in Raymond. It was a bitter experience for Rose, but there was nothing else for her to do, and she accepted the inevitable, brooding over the great change in her life and in many ways adding to the burden of Felicia and her cousin Rachel. Felicia at once found herself in an atmosphere of discipleship that was like heaven to her in its revelation of companionship. It is true that Mrs. Winslow was not in sympathy with the course that Rachel was taking, but the remarkable events in Raymond since the pledge was taken were too powerful in their results not to impress even such a woman as Mrs. Winslow. With Rachel, Felicia found a perfect fellowship. She at once found a part to take in the new work at the rectangle. In the spirit of her new life, she insisted upon helping in the housework at her aunt's, and in a short time demonstrated her ability as a cook, so clearly that Virginia suggested that she take charge of the cooking at the rectangle. Felicia entered upon this work with the keenest pleasure. For the first time in her life, she had the delight of doing something of value for the happiness of others. Her resolve to do everything after asking, "What would Jesus do?" touched her deepest nature. She began to develop and strengthen wonderfully. Even Mrs. Winslow was obliged to acknowledge the great usefulness and beauty of Felicia's character. The aunt looked with astonishment upon her niece, the city-bred girl, reared in the greatest luxury, the daughter of a millionaire, now walking around in her kitchen, her arms covered with flour and occasionally a streak of it on her nose. For Felicia at first had a habit of rubbing her nose forgetfully when she was trying to remember some recipe, mixing various dishes with the greatest interest in their results, washing up pans and kettles, and doing the ordinary work of a servant in the Winslow kitchen and at the rooms at the rectangle settlement. At first, Mrs. Winslow remonstrated. Felicia, it is not your place to be out here doing this common work. I cannot allow it. Why, Aunt? Don't you like the muffins I made this morning? Felicia would ask meekly, but with a hidden smile, knowing her aunt's weakness for that kind of muffin. They were beautiful, Felicia, but it does not seem right for you to be doing such work for us. Why not? What else can I do? Her aunt looked at her thoughtfully, noting her remarkable beauty of face and expression. You do not always intend to do this kind of work, Felicia. Maybe I shall. I have had a dream of opening an ideal cook shop in Chicago or some large city and going around to the poor families in some slum district like the rectangle, teaching the mothers how to prepare food properly. I remember hearing Dr. Bruce say once that he believed one of the great miseries of comparative poverty consisted in poor food. He even went so far as to say that he thought some kind of crime could be traced to soggy biscuit and tough beefsteak. I'm sure I would be able to make a living for Rose and myself and at the same time help others. Chapter 25. 3 months had gone by since the Sunday morning when Dr. Bruce came into his pulpit with the message of the new discipleship. They were 3 months of great excitement in Nazareth Avenue Church. Never before had Reverend Calvin Bruce realized how deep the feeling of his members flowed. He humbly confessed that the appeal he had made met with an unexpected response from men and women who, like Felicia, were hungry for something in their lives that the conventional type of church membership and fellowship had failed to give them. But Dr. Bruce was not yet satisfied for himself. He cannot tell what his feeling was or what led to the movement he finally made. To the great astonishment of all who knew him, better than by relating a conversation between him and the bishop at this time in the history of the pledge in Nazareth Avenue Church. The two friends were, as before, in Dr. Bruce's house, seated in his study. "You know what I have come in this evening for?" the bishop was saying, after the friends had been talking some time about the results of the pledge with the Nazareth Avenue people. Dr. Bruce looked over at the bishop and shook his head. "I have come to confess that I have not yet kept my promise to walk in his steps in the way that I believe I shall be obliged to if I satisfy my thought of what it means to walk in his steps." Dr. Bruce had risen and was facing his study. The bishop remained in the deep easy chair with his hands clasped, but his eye burned with the blow that belonged to him before he made some great resolve. "Edward," Dr. Bruce spoke abruptly, "I have not been able to satisfy myself either in obeying my promise, but I have at last decided on my course. In order to follow it, I shall be obliged to resign from Nazareth Avenue Church." "I knew you would," replied the bishop quietly, "and I came in this evening to say that I shall be obliged to do the same thing with my charge." Dr. Bruce turned and walked up to his friend. They were both laboring under a repressed excitement. "Is it necessary in your case?" asked Bruce. "Yes. Let me state my reasons. Probably they are the same as yours. In fact, I am sure they are." The bishop paused a moment, then went on with increasing feeling. "Calvin, you know how many years I have been doing the work of my position, and you know something of the responsibility and care of it. I do not mean to say that my life has been free from burden-bearing or sorrow, but I have certainly led what the poor and desperate of this sinful city would call a very comfortable, yes, a very luxurious life. I've had a beautiful house to live in, the most expensive food, clothing, and physical pleasures. I have been able to go abroad at least a dozen times and have enjoyed for years the beautiful companionship of art and letters and music and all the rest of the very best. I have never known what it meant to be without money or its equivalent, and I have been unable to silence the question of late, what have I suffered for the sake of Christ? Paul was told what great things he must suffer for the sake of his Lord. Maxwell's position at Raymond is well taken when he insists that to walk in the steps of Christ means to suffer. Where has my suffering come in? The petty trials and annoyances of my clerical life are not worth mentioning as sorrows or sufferings. Compared with Paul or any of the Christian martyrs or early disciples, I have lived a luxurious, sinful life, full of ease and pleasure. I cannot endure this any longer. I have that within me which of late rises in overwhelming condemnation of such a following of Jesus. I have not been walking in his steps. Under the present system of church and social life, I see no escape from this condemnation except to give the most of my life personally to the actual physical and soul needs of the wretched people in the worst part of this city. The bishop had risen now and walked over to the window. The street in front of the house was as light as day, and he looked out at the crowds passing, then turned and with a passionate utterance that showed how deep the volcanic fire in him burned, he exclaimed, "Calvin, this is a terrible city in which we live. its misery, its sin, its selfishness upon my heart. And I have struggled for years with the sickening dread of the time when I should be forced to leave the pleasant luxury of my official position to put my life into contact with the modern paganism of this century. The awful condition of the girls in some great business places, the brutal selfishness of the insolent society, fashion and wealth that ignores all the sorrow of the city, the fearful curse of the drink and gambling hell, the wail of the unemployed, the hatred of the church by countless men who see in it only great piles of costly stone and upholstered furniture, and the minister as a luxurious idler. All the vast tumult of this vast torrent of humanity, with its faults and its true ideas, its exaggeration of evils in the church, and its bitterness and shame that are the result of many complex causes. All this as a total fact in its contrast with the easy, comfortable life I have lived, fills me more and more with a sense of mingled terror and self-accusation. I have heard the words of Jesus many times lately. Inasmuch as you did it not unto one of these least my brethren, you did it not unto me. And when have I personally visited the prisoner, or the desperate, or the sinful in any way that has actually caused me suffering? Rather, I have followed the conventional soft habits of my position, and have lived in the society of the rich, refined, aristocratic members of my congregation. Where is the suffering from them? What have I suffered for Jesus' sake? Do you know, Calvin, he turned abruptly toward his friend, I have been tempted of late to lash myself with a scourge. If I had lived in Martin Luther's time, I should have bared my back to a self-inflicted torture. Dr. Bruce was very pale. Never had he seen the bishop or heard him when under the influence of such passion. There was a sudden silence in the room. The bishop sat down again and bowed his head. Dr. Bruce spoke at last. Edward, I do not need to say that you have expressed my feelings also. I have been in a similar position for years. My life has been one of comparative luxury. I do not, of course, mean to say that I have not had trials and discouragements and burdens in my church ministry, but I cannot say that I have suffered any for Jesus. That verse in Peter constantly haunts me. Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that he should follow his steps. I have lived in luxury. I do not know what it means to want. I also have had my leisure for travel and beautiful companionship. I have been surrounded by the soft, easy comforts of civilization. The sin and misery of this great city have beaten like waves against the stone walls of my church and of this house in which I live. I have hardly heeded them. The walls have been so thick. I have reached the point where I cannot endure this any longer. I am not condemning the church. I love her. I am not forsaking the church. I believe in her mission, and have no desire to destroy. Least of all, in the step I am about to take, do I desire to be charged with abandoning the Christian fellowship. But I feel that I must resign my place as pastor of Nazareth Church in order to satisfy myself that I am walking as I ought to walk in his steps. In this action, I judge no other minister and pass no criticism on other discipleship. But I feel as you do. Into a close contact with the sin and shame and degradation of this great city, I must come personally. And I know that to do that I must sever my immediate connection with Nazareth Heavenly Church. I do not see any other way for myself to suffer for his sake if I feel that I ought to suffer. Again that sudden silence fell over those two men. It was no ordinary action they were deciding. They had both reached the same conclusion by the same reasoning, and they were too thoughtful, too well accustomed to the measuring of conduct to underestimate the seriousness of their position. What is your plan? The bishop at last spoke gently, looking with a smile that always beautified his face. The bishop's face grew in glory now every day. My plan, replied Dr. Bruce slowly, is, in brief, the putting of myself into the center of the greatest human need I can find in this city and living there. My wife is fully in accord with me. We have already decided to find a residence in that part of the city where we can make our personal lives count for the most. Let me suggest a place. The bishop was on fire now. His fine face actually glowed with the enthusiasm of the movement in which he and his friend were inevitably embarked. He went on and unfolded a plan of such far-reaching power and possibility that Dr. Bruce, capable and experienced as he was, felt amazed at the vision of a greater soul than his own. They sat up late and were as eager and even glad as if they were planning for a trip together to some rare land of unexplored travel. Indeed, the bishop said many times afterward that the moment of his decision was reached to live the life of personal sacrifice he had chosen, he suddenly felt an uplifting, as if a great burden were taken from him. He was exultant. So was Dr. Bruce from the same cause. Their plan, as it finally grew into a workable fact, was in reality nothing more than the renting of a large building formerly used as a warehouse for the brewery, reconstructing it and living in it themselves in the very heart of a territory where the saloon ruled with power, where the tenement was its filthiest, where vice and ignorance and shame and poverty were congested into hideous forms. It was not a new idea. It was an idea started by Jesus Christ when he left his Father's house and forsook the riches that were his in order to get nearer humanity, and by becoming a part of its sin, helping to draw humanity apart from its sin. The university settlement idea is not modern. It is as old as Bethlehem and Nazareth, and in this particular case, it was the nearest approach to anything that would satisfy the hunger of these two men to suffer for Christ. There had sprung up in them at the same time a longing that amounted to a passion to get nearer the great physical poverty and spiritual destitution of the mighty city that throbbed around it. How could they do this except as they became a part of it, as nearly as one man can become a part of another's misery? Where was the suffering to come in unless there was an actual self-denial of some sort? And what was to make that self-denial apparent to themselves or anyone else unless it took this concrete, actual, personal form of trying to share the deepest suffering and sin of the city? So they reasoned for themselves, not judging others. They were simply keeping their own pledge to do as Jesus would do, as they honestly judged he would do. That was what they had promised. How could they quarrel with the result if they were irresistibly compelled to do what they were planning to do? Chapter 26. Meanwhile, Nazareth Avenue Church was experiencing something never known before in all its history. The simple appeal on the part of its pastor to its members to do as Jesus would do had created a sensation that still continued. The result of that appeal was very much the same as in Henry Maxwell's church in Raymond, only this church was far more aristocratic, wealthy, and conventional. Nevertheless, when, one Sunday morning in early summer, Dr. Bruce came into his pulpit and announced his resignation, the sensation deepened all over the city. Although he had advised his board of trustees, and the movement he intended was not a matter of surprise to them. But when it became publicly known that the bishop had also announced his resignation and retirement from the position he had held so long, in order to go and live himself in the center of the worst part of Chicago, the public astonishment reached its height. But why? The bishop replied to one of his valued friends who had almost with tears tried to dissuade him from his purpose. Why should what Dr. Bruce and I propose to do seem so remarkable a thing? As if it were unheard of that a doctor of divinity and a bishop should want to save souls in this particular manner. If we were to resign our charge for the purpose of going to Bombay or Hong Kong or any place in Africa, the churches and the people would exclaim at the heroism of missions. Why should it seem so great a thing if we have been led to give our lives to help rescue the heathen and the lost of our own city in the way we are going to try it? Is it then such a tremendous event that two Christian ministers should be not only willing but eager to live close to the misery of the world in order to know it and realize it? Is it such